This is the Liminalist, the podcast between, this is Jason Horsley, in between the podcast, the Liminalist, talking to cryptocubrologist Alex Fulton. Seems like a segue, because the parallel between real life and virtual life is kind of central to, I think, well, you can agree or not, but our mutual interest in Kubrick.
Yeah.
And I haven't been obsessing over this podcast, needless to say, because I do it every week, so you know, I'd be toast if I got all fired up before podcast, but I did have one sort of cluster of thoughts, and it has to do with, obviously, with Kubrick in a specific sense, but in a general sense with agreement and disagreement, and how I find that a topic of interest in and of itself, you know, how important it is to reach agreement with people, but specifically with you and I, like there's been quite a bit of disagreement between us, I would say, probably, you know, more than average, even though, you know, I can be pretty disagreeable, I know.
well, I can too.
And it occurred to me that, you know, despite that, and maybe it's related, there's this area of real agreement between us, which is our interest in Kubrick. Now, of course, it's sort of ironical, because that's also our area of disagreement in many senses.
Mm-hmm.
But I was thinking, if we strip it down or just start from the basics, like, you've got crypto Kubrick.
Cryptocubrology.
Thank you. Cryptocubrology. And I'd say it's kind of in the past now, but it's, you know, nothing's ever in the past, really, the Kubrick-Con.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought we could just start with that anyway, like, because I think we'll find out, but I think actually they're very similar. I think what you're investigating and what I was investigating are really, really similar. We just have different methods, different conclusions, and so on. I thought we could start there. So if you can describe what cryptocubrology is in a couple of lines, and then I'll try and do it for Kubrick-Con, and we'll see how close they are.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
That's a tough one. Well, let's see. I guess I'll just say what is on the front page of cryptocubrology, or Sean Fella, his website, where he says it's like a word he came up with based on cryptozoology, obviously, which sort of is about kind of siphoning through, well, Kubrick's films, but not just Kubrick films. It's pretty much all films, and in fact, all media, and really all history as well, on the premise that this is some sort of, I'm going to say puzzle. And I also am very conscious of, like, simplification, and because when I say it's a puzzle, I don't want to reduce it to that, but since we're doing a nutshell here, it's sort of like a puzzle. And like a puzzle, there are different pieces, and there is the promise of a picture that's being put together. And it's all sort of held together through time and the calendar and the way we measure time. And so we look at it when a movie came out and another movie and how it relates in terms of literally how many days in between, and you look at these numbers. I'm already going off the rails here because it's difficult to describe, but it's a mix of numerology, of film analysis.
Mm-hmm.
I am going to read the sentence and then I'm going to turn it over to you because it's a little bit better. It means, okay, digging through the works of Stanley Kubrick on the premise that its body is a muted mass of coded Kabbalistic ministrations comparable in scope to the works of William Shakespeare, but incomparable in complexity to anything in recorded history. In fact, cryptocubrology has led to an entirely different view of so-called history itself. And then there's a little Tolstoy quote where it says, history would be something extraordinary if only it were true. And so I think that's a kind of a decent way of putting it. But again, it's like, it's hard to describe. Such a subjective thing.
Well, that's closer to what I thought it probably was. when you just read the sentence, and closer to the reason I thought that there was a definite overlap with Kubrickon.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll try and sum up Kubrickon now. It's been a while. The idea was that it was a kind of going to be a collective thing, hence the forum, and that mm-hmm. didn't ever really happen. I mean, there was one very long argument with Sweaty K, with Keith, about 2001, which was enjoyable and kind of satisfying, but also frustrating. And then there were, a few people here and there, and then you and I at RI got into it a little bit. But so far as I did have this fixed idea that I wanted to demonstrate, it had to do with the notion that Kubrick's oeuvre itself made up a kind of collective, words are failing me already, memeplex, mm-hmm. and that Kubrick had designed them this way, whatever level of consciousness, all of that was designed with Kubrick, or through Kubrick, not necessarily by him, but with his participation by unknown agencies, as a sort of cultural grid that was aimed to siphon off the awareness and attention of individuals, let's say, to create a Kubrick audience cult. All of this quite obsessive attention that was being directed at Kubrick, his work, praising it, analysing it, all the rest of it, imitating it, other filmmakers, that all of that was getting drawn into this memeplex of the Kubrickon, that what Kubrick was attempting to do was create AI using the internet, that he anticipated the internet. So, the Kubrick mania began prior to the internet. But then when the internet came in, it started to become much more organized and more structured, obviously a lot bigger, and of course directly hooked into computers. So then you could say that the internet entire was designed for the same, say Facebook as well, as a sort of strange attractor for human psychic energy, attention, data, etc., that would inform, the computer, the superstructure of computers, and eventually with the aim to making it sentient. So that would be the whole of the internet, but that Kubrick was kind of a forerunner of this, and that the whole Kubrickon is a sort of model of how that might work, how computers could be made sentient by attracting and siphoning off human attention, human interest.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of agreement between us, because I think a lot of what you just said is like almost describes cryptocubrology better than I could. I'm trying to figure out where we actually do disagree. I think it might just be like you don't like his movies and I do.
No, I think it, well, there's that, and we could get to that. That's less sensitive. Huh? Go ahead.
Oh, there is definitely more, but that was the first thing.
Yeah, that's the really obvious one, of course. But then there's the why, why I don't like them. I like The Shining, sure. I like Barry Lyndon. It's not like monolithic about it.
Exactly.
But then there's the other, there's more sensitive area of agreement, which is, okay, so... I mean, it isn't necessarily sensitive or personal. It's also general, and it has to do with, to what extent... Okay, so let's bring it to hubrology. Now, one of the questions I would have for you or for Sean Feller, who coined the whole thing or, you know, started the whole thing, is, you know, have you considered, or would you, or have you been doing, have you been trying out these methods, this methodology, with other subjects? Like, have you tested to see whether it would be equally effective with Sam Wood or Michael Winner, you know, or Alan Smithy, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's obviously one of the first questions that I think needs to be asked there. And so,
sure. You know,
what do you say to that question?
Well, yes. When you say those three names, I only recognized Alan Smithy as being a fake person, or just whatever that is, you know. So do you mean, is there a particular type of, like, alternate subject you're thinking of, or just any other director?
Anyone, yeah, anyone.
Okay, well then yes, because while it sort of starts with Kubrick, and it's sort of centered around Kubrick, it leads everywhere else, and everyone, there are so many other directors that I've looked at. I mean, it sort of involves everyone, but there are certain individuals that are more highly charged based on the sort of strength of the relationships that are found through history, and subjects of movies or things that are tangentially related to Kubrick, or particularly, like, a good example, I think, is Paul Thomas Anderson, who is, like, if anybody, is kind of the Kubrick of our day, because he's this auteur who makes these big tent event movies, and everybody compares him to Kubrick, and he's, and so I have looked at him. He was one of the first people I looked at, and I looked at his movies and found some spectacular things, one of the problems with talking about it is there's so much sort of tedium in this data. Like, I could list off all these numbers and these dates, but it's kind of hard to do that in casual conversation because it just sort of washes over you.
But also, this is our area of disagreement, you see, because I don't see significance. I've yet to see significance in tracing these patterns.
Right.
And see, my hypothesis is that the Kubrickon is designed to ensnare people into doing that in order to make the thing sentient, and in order to create connections that didn't exist previously. So, and I was conscious about saying create, because I'm not saying that you're imagining them. They become real if you find them. But
sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give you just one good example, which is on the front page here, is that the time between the JFK assassination and the Robert F. Kennedy assassination, the two brothers, big events of the 60s, are separated by exactly 237 weeks. And to me, there's not a good explanation for that other than, well, I'm not going to say, but it implies things about the way history has unfolded and how it relates to The Shining and Kubrick that, to me, it's hard to deny once the sheer amount of these sort of things adds up. But that's a very good and startling one for me. Which I'll say again, between JFK and RFK assassinations, the two pretty much biggest events of the 1960s, I think we could probably agree, in terms of their impact on the collective sort of consciousness, are separated by exactly 237 weeks, which is the number of the room in The Shining.
Mm-hmm.
And so on the one hand, it is a subjective thing because, you know, I'm making the connection between that and the movie, but it's objective in the fact that it is. I mean, I didn't make that happen. You know, that's just a fact.
No, but you've helped create the context in which it's significant. I mean, I agree that Kubrick has also. I mean, at this point, you
Right, I
can
would.
include Kubrick in creating a context that made that significant. So yeah, fair enough. But then, so then, what's? I'm assuming you're not going to have a single answer for this. But how would you try and explain that phenomena?
Well, this gets into this whole thing that Sean, I'll say Sean because Sean feels awkward, has called it what he thinks is a temporal algorithm. And I kind of agree with this. And it's really relates to modern day because I remember recently seeing us an AI as well, this article saying about how algorithms run the world, like all the computer systems, everything is Google, obviously, it's a big one, are based on algorithms, these sort of self-regulating systems. And so with this temporal algorithm, it's sort of, and nobody's going to buy this unless they've spent as much time looking at this as I have, but I'll say it, is that there seems to be this a temporal algorithm underwriting basically all of history, and it's built into the calendar and the way we have been sort of we've been guided towards measuring and meeting out time, metering out time. So the only reason that there are 237 weeks between JFK and RFK is because we have set up this system of weeks of 7 days and 24 hours that are, and that's the only reason. If we did it based on some other calendar, that wouldn't be there. So, like to really get to the bottom of this, you start looking at the calendar itself and how it was created and who created it. And one of the people, and I think actually pretty sure this is the guy who actually made the final adjustments to the calendar, which happened I think in the 17th century, was Christopher Clavius. And if you remember your 2001, Clavius Base is the place on the moon, which has had this the fake outbreak or whatever that they have the cover story where they say, oh, there's an outbreak on Clavius, so that's why you can't go here. But the real thing is they found this monolith. So that's sort of a direct correlation between 2001 and the calendar. Obviously there's a crater named after the guy on the moon, so he picked that name.
Right. Wait, you mean there, but there actually is one on the moon.
I'm
Yeah,
pretty sure.
so Arthur C. Clarke or Kubrick just picked that out of
Yeah, one
reality.
of the two. Whoever made that decision. And then the other thing, quick to qualify here, is the idea of intention and who, whether or not Kubrick himself, the man who was alive, was intentionally, doing these things, or whether he was being guided unconsciously by something, some other, as you say, put it, other agencies. Which I was kind of curious if you meant agencies as in like the CIA, or if you meant agencies in the more broader sense of like,
Right. Well, I mean, that's also my question to you, because we're going to be, gazing into a mirror, really, or infinite mirrors when we try and if we were trying to try and answer that. But it doesn't mean it's not worth asking the
Sure.
question. Like, so, but both is the obvious answer
Right.
there. And I mean, because what you're talking about could be accounted for with a mystical explanation, as in this is the implicate order of creation, and there is a numerological basis to reality, and that's it, right? And Kubrick either got lucky, or he had inside information, or he was just, visionary and very intuitive, or a combination of all three.
Sure.
I mean, I don't happen to think that. I think there is more to that. I think there is human intention there, and I think that includes Kubrick. Where
Oh
I'm
yeah,
most
yeah.
sure about Kubrick's intention, however, in this, I mean, this is a kind of personal thing, and we can get to why maybe it has to do with false gurus and my whole, quest to dethrone the emperor or show the emperor is naked. That whole thing that is in my psychology, that where I can see Kubrick's intention most clearly was to mythologize himself.
Right. I think there's no question about that. I think he did that. I think he did that intentionally. I kind of tend to think, and this may be me, this may be a product of his mythologizing even, but that he was extremely intentional about everything he did. And so I agree with you when you said at some point that he made a mission to sort of place himself as the greatest filmmaker of all time, regardless of whether or not that's true, even though that's sort of a subjective thing. But objectively, he's succeeded. And how and why, I think I'm led to similar conclusions as you, is that there is a program that he was sort of intent on enacting, or, you know, it could be, I could go either way, that he didn't say that, you know, on Tuesday I'll think that he did this all intentionally to reveal things to the masses and to raise consciousness, and then on Thursday I'll think, well, he did this to conceal and to misdirect. And then on Friday, I think he's specifically talking to me. Like, so it sort of gets weird and almost embarrassing to talk about, because sometimes I have had certain experiences with media where it's like there's no other explanation other than Kubrick is reading my emails. Either way, it's all over the map.
In time. He would have to be traveling through time from the past and reading them, yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Or being somehow outside of time and looking on it as, and not just Kubrick here, but whatever kind of entity. An alien, even.
When I was a child, my parents took me to the circus to see the flying trapeze, the acrobats and jugglers who juggled with fire. My favorite was the man who walked the high wire. He walked straight and steady, so high above us all, and I gasped every time he pretended to fall. But I knew if he fell, he wouldn't fall to his death, for under his feet a safety net. When I left school, my parents took me to work alongside them at the factory. The work it was heavy and the work it was hard, but in everyone's pocket was a union card. With my brothers and sisters, we worked with our hands against the bosses and the blacklegs. We made our stand, and I knew if I fell on hard times or bad luck, my friends and the union would help me back up. When they got into power in 79, the Tories fought hard to cut the unions down. They fought long and dirty, grind us to dust, to make the world more unequal, unfair and unjust. For the rich want a world of endless wealth for themselves and their friends and nobody else. But all that we wanted was to be fairly paid and to know we had help when the times were hard. Now my parents have gone, the world it has changed. New Labour, the Condems and the Tories again. The rich help themselves day after day, and that old safety net, well, they took it away. Oh, I miss the old world where the unions were strong, where brothers and sisters helped each other along. And I miss how it felt when I knew for sure that something would stop me from falling too far. Will someone please stop me from falling too far?
Right. So, well, this is, I think this is close to the crux of what I was trying to uncover with the Kubrickon, which is this, the idea of the naked emperor and how we only see the emperor's clothes because we generate the image of clothing, right? Because of our own discomfort, our own needs and whatnot. And I trace this in Kubrick's method, the way he, much of what he films and in his films is kind of neutral, or it's kind of blank, and I would even say with Eyes Wide Shut, it's kind of vampiric, like there's something about the scenes which are so lifeless that we have to animate them just because it's unbearable otherwise. I haven't put it like that before until now, but anyway, so this notion that an individual can become an archetypal presence in our own consciousness only through our investment in them, and part of how they do that, which I explore with John DeRuiter, first unconsciously and then consciously, is by presenting a very large but very blank screen, so monolith even, that we can interpret in many different ways, but that it has a certain resonance, like the sound of the monolith or the sound of John DeRuiter's silence or the symmetry of Kubrick's photography, what have you. It has a certain resonance that stirs something in us, which is a feeling of the numinous, a feeling of our own longing to connect to the soul and to our, the father we didn't have, and so on, those deep psychological wounds or holes within our psyche get somehow stirred up in us, and then we will conjure up, the fantasy, the imagery that we will then project onto the screen or the monolith and attribute it to that thing, right?
Yeah.
And well, this is an ironic paradox, because it does require a kind of genius or a kind of whatever to get people to do that, but what it doesn't require is integrity or honesty, right? As I saw with DeRuiter, like, the guy's a creep, really, it seems like.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I think that's very much the case, but I correct me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about in terms of like movies or cinema or media as the screen. This isn't really in contrast to what you're saying, but that my thought is that the movies are just sort of a highly charged microcosm of life itself. So the screen, I tend to think of reality as being just, it's information, really, what we're seeing. Like, I see, it's hard to explain, you probably understand what I'm talking about, but that as we go through our days, we're being given information, and our brain sort of decodes it and turns it right side up, as the sort of eyes, how the eyes work, and which is exactly the way a camera works. And so our perception is the lens to focus these things, and what movies do, and media in general, is just hyper focus this energy and sort of mirror it back at us. And this whole sort of study has really led me to question, well, everything really, but that what are movies? What is, like, cinema? Like, it's obviously, well, movies are a projection or an invention of playing with light and camera, but they're also like little snippets of time, and because before a movie, you couldn't take life and play it back and look at it and examine it and take it apart, but you can do it with a movie, which has been consciously sort of created by a consciousness, and charged with that sort of magical energy. And so I kind of lost my train of thought here.
Throughout reality, I guess, is being...
Yeah, and so these tropes that sort of emerge in movies based on this analysis sort of, they're everywhere. It's not just movies. It's the whole thing. It's everywhere you look, really. And it's sort of in my head, the idea is like when you have a map, a flat map, and you like paper map, and you set it out, and then you have another piece. Imagine like a transparency piece overlaying it with like certain like parts circled or X's here or there, and you put it on the map, and it sort of reveals this alternate sort of intention or purpose to the map. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how I see this whole cryptocubrology thing, is that there's certain patterns and tropes and numbers that are used to sort of reveal the underlying patterns that exist in nature, or unnature, or whatever humans are, because I'm not convinced we're...
It's back to this crux again, then. As whether... I mean, whether what you're uncovering with this algorithm, if you are, is part of, you know, nature, the Fibonacci sequence, etc., and that Kubrick was trying to adhere to that, or his handlers, and so on, or whether it's something that's been imposed upon a deeper reality. And again, it might not be either or. I mean, if we're going to recognize or factor in that the existence is infinite and eternal, then that it means it's also formless. It can't be, it can't have any kind of structure, because, you know, structure can't be infinite. So then anything becomes an imposition at that point, like any kind of structured algorithmic, you know, shaping of reality.
Yes. Well, it's interesting because this number series, which is, for the record, is 42, 153, 237, and 666.
Oh, what sequence is that, then?
That's just the cryptocubrology temporal algorithm, or what are the numbers that the four kind of...
Okay, and how did
chess pieces.
Sean just pull those out of his hat, or...?
Well, what? That's what I was going to get to, is that it's actually... I mean, three of those... 42, 153, and 666 are all from the Bible, really. I mean, especially 153, which...
Yeah, the fishes.
Not that many people, yeah, the fishes, but it's also in some other places, which I can't remember at the moment. But, so, I think... I don't know if I've ever even asked him what the first moment was that he decided that these are the numbers, but these are just things that emerged. And so it's 42 is in the Bible. 42 is everywhere. It's become this its own meme, thanks to Douglas Adams and Hitchhiker's Guide.
And what is it in the Bible?
Well, it is so in the first book of the New Testament, which is Matthew, I think, he gives the genealogy of Christ, and he lays it out such that there are three groups of 14 names of generations, and 3 times 14 is 42. So Christ, you could say, is the 42nd generation of David. And this 314 thing is pi, the 3.14. So 3 times 14 is 42. So it's sort of this a loop. It sort of implies the loop, and how Christ is like the breaking of the loop, which I believe is pretty much what he says, or that he's there to break the cycle of whatever. I'm not a expert on that stuff, but
that doesn't ring a bell. But it would fit with other things. So be curious if you can find the source. And is there a mathematical sequence between these numbers? I mean, are they connected in some mathematical way, or are they just connected because Sean wanted to use them all?
Well. Yes, they are.
Like, could somebody work out what the next one is based on?
I don't know about that. We'll take 153, for example. If you take all the different permutations of 153, so you have 153, 351, 315, etc., etc., if you pair them in a certain way, they add up to 666 either way. So 153 plus 531, no, I'm sorry, 513 is 666. 351 plus 315, et cetera, et cetera, is all equals 666. And then, okay, and then 237, you break that down, 2 times 3 times 7 is 42. And then another thing that I like is, are you familiar with the number 432? Or have you heard that one?
Mm-mm.
It's sort of popular because people talk about, in terms of music, when you tune your music to 432 hertz, it's supposed to be like the God tone or whatever. It's supposed to, like, there's this whole idea that Western music was tuned to the wrong frequency, basically, to lower our consciousness or something. So when you tune it to 432, that's supposed to be the God thing. And so when you take 42 plus 153 plus 237, you get 432. And then 432 is part of this series where if you double it, you have 864, and the sun is 864,000 miles wide or something along those lines. That's all very, like, well-documented stuff. So it's sort of like taking these numbers in this cosmic sequence, because there's a lot of work, particularly Scott Onstott. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he does these things of measuring the radius of the planets and the distances between things on the planet, on Earth, as they relate to these number series, and finding that all these things are kind of interrelated. So 432 broken down gives you three of the four Kurology numbers, and then 666 is its own kind of thing.
Right.
There are, I don't know if you could, like, just say, give a person 42 and then figure out the rest of them. I don't think you could do that.
Not from one, no, but usually if you've got five or something, you can extrapolate.
It would be interesting to see. But I really, these things are just sort of, I think, imposed by media, really, that's where they kind of come, because that's all, after all, what the Bible is ultimately, is a piece of media.
Well, that's true. Did you look into the Bible code, that whole thing, when it was, there was a period where, I mean, I heard about it, and it was just so unbelievable that I couldn't be bothered to look into that, you know?
But I haven't really, there's so many, when you get into analyzing the Bible, there's just so much noise out there.
Right. Well, the specific Bible code was supposedly that you can find out anything that's going to happen in the future if you know how to decode it, including the day that you're going to die personally, and so on and so forth. I
sort of sympathize with that idea. I don't think I could predict anything specifically, but I have definitely used this algorithm to very disturbing effect in terms of not predicting, but pinpointing the things, significant dates, not necessarily what will happen, but that something will happen. And yeah,
so there was a period a few years ago, it didn't go very far, it didn't even go as far as the Kubicon, where I was running a little online group, and the objective of it was, well, part of it was kind of a sort of whatever imagination exercise, but it was to try and figure out if we were living in a virtual reality. So it was a sort of pretext, really, because the goal was examination, just to examine one's life and be more aware of everything, and this just seemed like a kind of good sci-fi context to put in it. But it was also, I mean, there was also a grain of literal meaning in that. I've never believed that we're literally in a computer simulation, as in hardware, I don't suppose I ever will, but I do believe that we are in a matrix of some kind, and that this reality, the way that we experience reality, as in, you know, Alex Fulton's day-to-day existence, Jason Horsley's day-to-day existence, is not, certainly not absolute. Like, there are other existences that I have experienced while asleep, let's say, that are equally complete, contained realities. I'm pretty sure about that. And even though I know that if I say it as words, I kind of, it's almost self-contradictory. And that was my experience as well, is that when I was in this other reality, it was the only reality, and I absolutely knew that. It was just that I had the memory of being in another reality, of this I'm in now talking to you, and when I was in this reality, that was the only reality. It's not as though they're, you know, just on the other side of a veil. It's very weird. It's like when you're inside one reality, that's it. There is no other reality, and yet somehow consciousness, my consciousness, whatever, seems able to, you know, move between these realities that don't exist until you're in them. So, I mean, it's not a rational thing. Yeah. I mean, I'm babbling at this point, but the point is that at some deep, maybe almost visceral level, I do experience this and have since I was a kid, that, you know, what we think of as reality isn't. So bringing it back, you know, to Kubrology, and, I mean, you know, one of the themes I get when I hear this stuff, and one of the reasons that, you know, there's been some, you know, a prickliness between us, is that I can sometimes feel a kind of real despair and anxiety at the thought of you or anyone else, you know, crunching all these numbers and spending hours sifting through this data. you know, I respect the sort of obsessive detective energy, of course. But it's also because I at least at a rational level, I then interpret that feeling of, well, you know, what if this is just, and people have said this to me, what if this is just digging oneself deeper into the reality? Like if you know, because what you're describing to me, and you can correct me and interrupt me even if I'm wrong, but is like an attempt to see the code. I mean, to use the media provided metaphor of Neo, at the end of the movie, he sees the code, he sees that the reality he thought was reality is just numbers.
Yes.
And that's what you're revealing to yourself. But my question is, you know, would be to myself and to you, is, you know, does it actually work that way? Does it work if we can actually start to see the numbers by working out where they're going to be? Is that going to allow us to actually draw aside the veil and see the code, as opposed to the way Neo did it? He just, you know, popped. At some point he popped, he could see it. He didn't have to go, oh, there's a 237 over there, and that leads, you know what I mean? There was no intellectual process in that.
Sure. Well, I think the whole story kind of starts with he's searching for something, right? He knows there's an answer to it. Sounds so cliche when I say it, but, and I think for me, my experience of reality is just before all of, I got into all this stuff, really, before I even got into sync, as they say, my feeling was just that this is just so strange that we're here, that I exist. This is just the most impossible thing I could imagine. Like, for me, a lot of people, it just seems like people go about their business, you know, go to, you know, day to day, going to work, but nobody seems to stop and think, like, whoa, wait a second, what? It's this impossible recursive thing of why am I here? Why am I here? Why is this here? There's got to be a good explanation. And so that sort of led me just down this path that I'm on, and I don't know if I have any. I don't have any answers. Do I expect to get any answers? Deep down, maybe. I don't know. I know that the power of some of the experiences I've had through this sort of methodology is really pretty undeniable. Personally, for me, I mean, I don't at this point care if anybody else, you know, sees it. Although I would like that, and it always makes me happy when somebody messages me or says something to me about it, but, you know, it's not necessary. It's ultimately a personal quest, I think. I don't know if that answered your question at all. ¶¶
I don't know if it even was a question, but well, but what you said was very poignant, and it's something that I also continue to have on a daily basis is the cognitive dissonance of consciousness. Let's say there's just an inherent cognitive dissonance in being conscious. Conscious of being here, being self-conscious, I guess that's what it is. So I'd like to stay on that. And one of the, you know, one of the ways that I've become able to cognize the cognitive dissonance, as in, yeah, because it's a visceral, or if we're going to use that word, and maybe that's too easy, but it's a, it's not really, it's not a rational experience, that that amazement at being here, I don't think. It's just kind of inherent, if we, for me, I should say, if I become aware. Actually, for me, it was often nightmarish, to be frank. The awareness of my own awareness would generally be accompanied by an absolutely palpable sense of not being real. So, and that is absolute cognitive dissonance, because I'm becoming conscious of the fact, the experience that I'm not here, that I'm not real, but what is it that's having the experience of not being real, right? You know, there's an inherent cognitive dissonance in that. And I could go into, you know, what I think that is, because I do think that's a psychological phenomenon. I mean, they call it depersonalization, but I think there's a, you know, there's a meaningful interpretation of that. But what I was getting to was that more recently, in recent years, I've also hit upon a very rational understanding of that cognitive dissonance, which is actually that the mathematical odds of us being here are zero. Time has been going on eternally, and it will continue eternally after we're gone. So how is it possible that we're here in this precise moment? It actually isn't mathematically. And that, although that, you know, you could say that to most people and they just don't get it, because, well, we've got to be here sometime, so, you know. But so you have to have both. You have to have this just innate sense of disbelief that we're here, for that mathematical thing to resonate. But anyway, I don't know where I was going with that exactly. I suppose, but, you know, back to the Neo thing, that, you know, to me, you're talking about answers, and of course I get this question, and I have this question myself, you know, do I really think I'm ever going to find out the truth about, you know, my own past, and about the, you know, the programs of control and abuse and all the rest of it? Do I really think that all my existential detective work is going to lead to, you know, the body in the garden, and the arrest of the criminal, and a nice, you know, wrapped up Columbo kind of ending? Well, no, I don't. So then what I've had to allow for, you know, more and more is, and talk about more and more, is that it doesn't actually have to, because what needs to happen is not at a rational deductive level anyway. It's to do with, like, we as organisms experience being in existence in a way that I think is not conflicted. Like, there isn't, I don't think there's an organic cognitive dissonance about being here, you know. It's just kind of, we're just responding to the environment. It's the mind that can't encompass the improbability of our being here. That's at a mental level. What I'm getting to here, it won't end with a question, but hopefully it'll leave an opening for you, is that I'm just keeping my mind busy, really, making it think that it can figure this out, so that it will. But at the same time, it is focusing on the ultimate mystery, which is, who am I? What am I? You know, my focus is on that, and although the mind is never going to find it, it keeps it occupied while, while something else happens. I'll just say, I won't say any more, because
something to pass the time. I'm with you. I think it comes down to maybe personality, or just history, or of personal history, that, you know, what what am I even saying here? That some people are content to not ask the question, or they just don't see life that way. Like I have a friend who is a longtime friend and who just doesn't care. I mean, he just doesn't care. Just when I try to say like, "Oh, do you think the moon landing really happened or whatever?" His response is kind of just like, I don't know. How am I? I can't ever know. So why should I? Why should that matter to me really? And so for me, I think it matters entirely. Like it's the whole crux of history and what it means about media. It's just so I'm just personally, and I think to do the astrology thing, I'm a Scorpio, so I'm interested in the mysteries of the universe, I guess. And I also like to brag that I have the same birthday as Terence McKenna, November 16th. So, and in a way, I mean, I know you have your bones to pick with him as well, but I see his stuff, particularly stuff about the time wave, to be kind of a forerunning kind of idea about this, what I'm doing, the similar approach to time, breaking it down. And again, I don't know if I've answered any questions that were asked or not asked, but
well, your friend who is content not to wonder why or if, is he generally a sort of more content person who, I mean, what other qualities would you describe him as having?
He's always been a kind of an artist, artistic intentions. He loves theater. He's a writer. He's a musician. He's a lover of animals. You know, just a kind of a good person. You know, he has struggles with the crushing realities of the workplace, I guess.
And but, he's not. You wouldn't describe him as unimaginative, generally.
No, not right. at all. Actually, he's very.
Yeah, I was just curious about it, because it could be healthy. I mean, what you're saying is, well, I'm never going to know, so why question? I think right. there is something in that. I mean, it's not my nature sure. either, by any means, as you know. But where I would question that, somebody who said that, is, well, like, you know, how much are we acting as if we believe stuff? Anyway, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
So is he, don't make it about him, but, you know, people who say, well, there's no point in questioning because you can't ever find out, are they really leaving it open? Like if somebody asked them, you know, when did right. man land on the moon, would they say, I don't know that man did land on the moon, or would they say 1969? You know, probably most of them would just say 1969.
Sure.
And if you press them, they might admit, well, no, I don't know for sure, but, and then they would have some lame answer for the but, as in, but, you know, well, I believe what the media tells me kind of thing. So, so this whole thing of questioning, I mean, I think where it becomes really essential to a human engagement with life, where I don't think there's any substitute for questioning, I'd say, is when it leads to questioning one's own beliefs about oneself, you know, the culture which has shaped our identity and our experience of ourselves, how much of it is lies? Well, a lot. And it may not be the only way to start to unravel one's own lies, but it certainly is a valid way. So, so that, as you know, that to me is always the thing. And it's interesting you say about Scorpio, because I got Scorpio South Node, and I got some Scorpionic qualities. And on the surface, you know, people could see that I got Pluto in the first house. So I have this desire to dig into the dark and uncover dark secrets, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I associate that with uncovering stuff that like real investigation, I guess, you know, is what makes me identify with the detective archetype. Real investigation for me entails uncovering crimes.
Yeah.
Right? So yeah. So then my predilection or my tendency when we're talking about Kubrickology and all that stuff is I want to identify the criminal. I don't want to hear about how great Kubrick is or how old this guy. I want you to expose these assholes, yeah. You know, who hypnotize us in the first place. So, so that's the kind of thing I bring to it.
One of the things with Kubrickology, it doesn't actually ignore, it's not like something that ignores these things because, as I say, there are these many different tropes that emerge when you look at media in this with this sort of lens. And one of them, probably a huge one, is child abuse and the institutional sort of whatever you want to call it that you're looking at. And it's getting into the same basically waters where why is this happening? Like, what is the point of this institutionalized abuse of children and MK Ultra and all of this stuff? Mm-hmm. And it sort of starts to, congeal into this sort of meta-narrative about possession and sort of the metaphor of puppetry, where human beings are sort of used and basically as puppets. And the movie Being John Malkovich is a kind of a cornerstone. For one reason being is that it was released 237 days after Kubrick died. So, and this is a movie about John Cusack, who goes into the body of another person and animates, who is a puppeteer who animates another person as a puppet. And that's the whole point. And in the original script, the ending was basically a confrontation with the devil. And in the actual movie, it's all about a cult that's trying to like achieve immortality and or incarnate the devil. So that's sort of where the kind of these clue, these breadcrumbs kind of lead towards some sort of overlap between child abuse, the manufacturing of sort of puppet sort of humans, mm-hmm. To be inhabited by, fill in the blank, you could say, really it looks like some sort of outside extra temporal agentry going on, and that sort of bleeds into pop culture. So you look at all these famous, and I remember when you did your interview on Leonard Cohen, that really charged a lot in my mind, where he's this popular, extremely successful artist who happened to go to McGill at the right time and was an MK Ultra subject, allegedly, I think he was. And so it sort of brings up this question of how does a person get famous, or how does a person succeed or become known, and I really do think at this point that sort of thing is manufactured through these sort of occult techniques. It's no accident. So that all of this really just to say that I'm definitely, this doesn't ignore those things that you talk about in favor of sort of it's aiming at the same place. It's just sort of a different, it's very peculiar way of getting there, I think. Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about John Malkovich on the way back before we talked, because of this original idea I brought up about agreement and disagreement and how we want some part of us, most of us, essentially we want everyone to agree with us, you know, the whole time. And if we had it, who knows, we probably wouldn't want it. But that's it reminded me of Being John Malkovich, because of the when it all goes wrong and he's just surrounded by himself, everybody turns into himself.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see Anomalisa?
No, I didn't. I meant to, but I never did.
You can
feel free to spoil things.
No, well, it wouldn't really be a spoiler because it's more thematic, but I think that you'll find it interesting because it'd be difficult to describe how he does this, but he conveys, it's not overtly science fiction, but it ends up science fiction. He even has a meeting with the devil, actually. And what it shows, very Phil K. Dickian, but it shows this character, the David Suess character, who goes through, I don't remember, it's been a while, but I don't remember.
Who's the actor?
David Suess.
Oh, gosh, he's been cropping up so much lately.
Yeah, I've got my own Suess story, but I won't get into that. Anyway, he has the experience of seeing the way in which everyone around him is basically have been turned into robots. I can't remember if it's literal or not. I think it might actually end up literal, but how I interpreted it, and it's more visceral an interpretation of how I experienced it, was he's seeing how everybody is locked into these constructed identities, these false identities. So, you know, like The Matrix, except it doesn't require an actual literal computer simulated reality. It's more like what you're saying, that people have been turned into puppets.
Yes. Yeah.
And they're being animated by something that is not their own souls.
Yes.
I touched on this with the transgender piece in the last part because I thought that, well, you know, there's a lot of room for misinterpretation around this subject, and people bring all their baggage to it, and so it might be helpful if I, even though it's not part of my thesis because I can't demonstrate this logically or anything, I better lay out, you know, what my viewpoint is and what might be going on here. And that was the passage about ancestral possession.
Right.
And, you know, and I was talking earlier about the feeling of cognitive dissonance I had as a child that was like, I'm not real. And I said, well, you know, I could talk more about that. What I understand that as being now was that as a child I was becoming aware of how my constructed identity was taking over my consciousness. And so I was still kind of in between, and I was still somewhat in tune with my psyche or my soul consciousness, my true authentic consciousness, but I was getting more and more identified with the constructed identity that was created as a defense against trauma and a hostile environment and so on. And so I was experiencing, you know, that tension and that horror, really, of being turned into a puppet doll or a poison container.
Yes. I like the term meat puppet.
Yeah. Yeah. So then it occurs to me, of course, seeing as we've been talking about Kubrick, that is a dead match for The Shining. The notion of ancestral possession.
Yeah.
Is a dead match for The Shining.
Definitely. And I think, I haven't actually read the book, but Dennis, my podcast cohort, read it recently and was talking about how it's sort of almost explicit in the book that his alcoholism is some form of ancestral possession, where, and there's the whole Native American thing going on underneath,
right,
but
right,
that
yeah.
When he, you know, what happens when he goes to the bar to get his drink, and that's when the ghosts appear.
The spirits.
Yes, the spirits, exactly. The bourbon. So yeah, I mean, I'm right on the same page there, and I think that is shows up in so many different aspects of our lives. With the trans thing, definitely, and the sort of, so you can in The Shining it's alcohol, but you could really say there's all kinds of sort of substances or things that sort of bring out these unconscious or tie you into some sort of super consciousness of that exists or is somehow kind of wheel, what's the word, wiggles its way inside your brain, figuratively, and sort of takes over. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm pretty much right. Agree with you. I don't know. I'm trailing off here. Save me.
That's okay. That's the end of the first part of my conversation with Alex Fulton. You can listen to part two next Wednesday, the 7th of July, 2017. I'd like to thank Matthew and Melissa for donating this week. If you'd like to support me in this podcast, keep oiling and greasing the wheels of liminality, you can go to horticulture.com/liminalist, or any page in the sidebar, you'll find a donate button there. Thanks for listening. This is Jason Horsley for the podcast Between.